surpass penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000,000,000 kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Oh, good evening, everybody. Nice gathering. Some people, old friends from near and far, or down the street, and some people that aren't new to me. So I hope that our Zen arrangements and our particular ways of standing and walking were not too confusing. We always try to work on being a little more clear. A few announcements before the talk, things that are going on in the community. This Friday we'll have, I think the third time we'll have children here at the Dharma Hall. So parents with children can come starting at 11:30. We have a really great children's teacher. And if it works with their kids, they can come and join us for meditation at noon. And come and go as they need to. And so far we've had a few babies, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old. And we'll see how it goes. And one thing that didn't occur to me about doing this is that it's turning out to be really great for people whose kids are grown or who don't have kids to just like come to the Dharma Center and hang out with kids. It turns out to be like a treat. So that is nice. I didn't think of that. Sadly, one can take for granted the joy of being with children when you get to do that 24 hours a day. So it's good to remember what a joy that is. So anyway, stop by if you have time on Friday in the middle of the day to sit a little and hang out with the kids. And, you know, don't sit if you want to. Just go down there and do art with the kids. That might be better. It might be more important, you know, way to spend your hour. And then a couple days later on Sunday, this Sunday, Latona here is leading a day hike, a silent day hike in the style that we've worked out on our 3-day backpacking retreats, which we're also doing in September, the first weekend of September, I think it is this year. So that's meeting here at 9, and it's a foolish day, but it's a gentle hike. Latona ran all around Chuckanut Mountain and found a fairly level hike, although he tells us there's like stinging nettles, so you might want to wear long pants. But it's hiking silently and stopping along the trail to do chanting. You're going to chant a short text by Dogen called the Genjo Koan, which is a wonderful text that we've studied before with Norman, so it's a good text for everybody to know. And bring a lunch, and I think there's maybe a few other points on the website about what to do. But 9 o'clock on Sunday for the day hike. And then Saturday, we have something every day. And then on Saturday, so Friday was the kids, Saturday afternoon is the second open house. We're having an open house on the farmers market days. And I guess the first one was very peaceful, very nice. Not a large number of people came, but a few people came who were really interested and really excited about Dharma and excited to see the Dharma Hall. And then plus it turned out to be, I was told, a very nice way for the people who were there volunteering to spend time together, you know. So if you're around, you know, if you're going to go to the market on Saturday, there'll be people here from noon to 3, so you could stop by if you like. And also, it could be a nice way if you have any friends who have expressed a little bit of interest. It could be a really safe way to check out the Dharma Hall. Nobody's going to make you meditate or anything like that. It's just a... Sounds like I'm anti-meditation. It's just an open house, you know. Just the idea is to just let people, you know, people have been curious, what's going on in there? Let's just invite them into the building and give them a brochure if they want, and such like that. So those were a few announcements. That was a little bit longish talk, as tends to happen with me. I apologize in advance. But it's something I'm really trying to explore, and it feels important to me, and I hope this will be useful to you, too, in your life. But lately, the last few days, I found myself really re-examining some of my attitudes towards my life. and especially my ambitions and my relationships to work and projects. And two events came together in this last weekend or so, to help me see more clearly the importance of a kind of learning how to do a kind of renunciation, learning how to let go of ambition and work with ambition more skillfully and more deliberately. And these things that happened with me really helped me see a lot more clearly how tight and grasping my attitude has been towards career and ambition. Which is funny because I've always thought of myself as a non-career person. And I think this is a common attitude among those of us who end up practicing. Many of us feel like we're not career people, that that's sort of square and bad, and maybe you don't feel that way, which is fine too. And even though I myself grew up middle class and went to college, I somehow felt myself a lineage holder in the sort of hippie movement, you know, even though I was younger than that, but some carrying on some important understanding about the futility of career and linear thinking and having, and, you know, and sort of towing the line, you know. And so in college, I studied what I felt like, which was ecology, environmental studies, just because that's what I was interested in. Even though from an economic standpoint, it would have been much more rational for me to get a degree in computer science, because I already had a pretty big leg up in computer science, so I was a little bit early to computers because my father was a physicist, so we had the very first ever personal computers in the house, you know, the first ones made we had, and I was already by 10 years old using them and programming them. And my first high school job after mowing the neighbor's lawn, I went from mowing the neighbor's lawn to being a computer programmer in a physics lab at 16 years old. I was probably 20 years younger than anybody else in the place. But somehow I'd absorbed from the air, or maybe from the things that I was imbibing, some countercultural attitudes towards career and ambition, and so I didn't do that. And that choice somehow established for me a strong theme in my story of who I am, which now seems to be unraveling a bit. That I'm someone somehow beyond career and beyond ambition. Someone who'll just do what comes up, respond, learn from it but not be attached, and move on. A kind of Zen, in quotes, sort of attitude from early on has always been part of my identity. I always thought of myself that way. And so after a year or two doing the career, I did do the career that I trained for in college for a couple of years, working for the national parks as a botanist, I gave it up because I didn't like it. I didn't like the lifestyle. It was seemed too remote to me, so I moved on to something else because I didn't need to stick with a career. And so that's how I moved to Bellingham. Janet and I moved to Bellingham to just do whatever we could find. We weren't worried about it. And initially, I made a very logical sort of planned segue. I did environmental education, teaching programs at Tennant Lake. And oddly, this very week, my own son is at the Tennant Lake Nature Day Camp, which is a program that I taught 18 years ago with Bob Penny, who was supposed to be here tonight, so he must have got sidetracked or something. And it's funny, you know, because for all my wishing that my son Walker would be more interested in nature, I've never been able to like get him to go on hikes, and he's really gets really bored and rolls his eyes when I try to tell him stuff about nature. But he goes to a Tennant Lake Nature Day Camp, and now he's totally excited about nature. Nature is like the coolest thing, and he knows a lot more about it than I do. Telling me all about bugs and birds. But anyway, that's another story, I guess. Something about parenting is that way. So anyway, after this sort of logical career-oriented step to environmental education in my middle 20s, after moving to Bellingham, I figured out there really wasn't that much work doing that, that I'd have to like be really ambitious and committed and look all around to try to be like a professional environmental educator. And so being that I was not a career person, I just started doing whatever I could find, odd jobbing it, working as a carpenter, a gardener, in the cabinetry shop. I continued to have like a seasonal job at Tennant Lake for a while. Nothing regular. And I felt very proud of myself that I could make my way in this way, living low to the ground, trusting that the universe would take care of me. I was a little bit proud of that. And then the teachers, I was interacting with school teachers at Tennant Lake when I was doing this environmental ed. You know, they bring the classes there. And several of these school teachers kept telling me, well, you should be a regular school teacher. And I was very, you know, I was very enthusiastic and very organized. And the kids loved me, you know, because, well, it's a good setup for the kids to love you because it's like their day out of the classroom, you know. They get to be outside, you know, one day a year, you know, they get to be outside. So the kids all loved me. It was really fun, actually. So the teacher said I should be a school teacher. So at about 31, I think I was, I went back to school to get a teaching credential. And I really got into it. You know, I studied hard. I learned lots of stuff about cognitive psychology and reading programs and how to teach math in a way that really was conceptually deep and important. And I got straight A's and cruised right through. But interestingly, studying to be a teacher involved, for me, the first significant time in my life that I had a strong experience of failure. Most of the things that I set out to do from growing up to high school to college were pretty easy, really. But in teacher training school, I failed, actually. I failed on my first attempt to do the student teaching. And the way they do the student teaching is pretty bizarre, so it's amazing that lots of people don't fail all the time. Maybe they do, I don't know. They probably don't tell you, you know. Half of you will fail and freak out, and they don't tell you that. But, you know, they, after sort of being off in the classroom, hanging around with adults, they just drop you in this class, this, you know, kid classroom. It's a completely separate thing. And if you're lucky, the teacher that you're assigned to is supportive and can help you bridge that sort of gap. If you're unlucky, not so. And I was going to, my original version of the talk had a long description of what happened, but there wasn't time, so I'll save that story for another day. But basically, I went in very confident, as I do with everything, and with a teacher who I was buddies with, and she wasn't really paying attention, and I wasn't really paying attention, and many of the kids came to really disrespect me and really think that I was like a joke, and it became like a project of theirs to help me fail. And the harder they pushed, the harder I tried. You know, the more earnest I was, the more clever lessons I cooked up, and the more, you know, wonderful writing assignments I brought them, which didn't work. And so actually one day I woke up in tears, and I couldn't go back to the student teaching. I had a kind of emotional breakdown. But then I figured, well, if you fail at something, you just try again. That must be what you do, not being too experienced with failure. And so I tried again. I pulled back, I had some counseling, and so on. I tried again, and this time the conditions were right, and I won awards. Literally, I won awards the second time. And before I knew it, I had a full-time professional teaching job, which was a bit of a coup. There's actually a lot of competition locally for teaching jobs. Other places in the country it's very easy, but here it's difficult. And the job I got was teaching on Lopez Island, which is like, you know, one of the prettiest places you can live in the Northwest. You know, just, it seemed like an amazing sort of coup. I was so happy, and every single person I met on Lopez Island was so excited, you know. They'd all heard about me. I should have, you know, there should have been warning bells going off, I guess. But I would meet people in the store who would say, oh, you're the new teacher. We've heard so good, such good things about you. We think you're going to be great, you know. But the job turned out to be a bit of a setup for an earnest, hardworking perfectionist that I seem to be. I did fine with most of the kids, and in fact, with a few, it was a very important year, and I was an important teacher for them. But with the adults, I did not do so well. The adults did not meet my expectations of the kind of people that would be teaching in the school. And especially there was a teacher I was supposed to be collaborating closely with. It was kind of a combined program, teaching fourth and fifth grade together. And she, after a while, decided to become my enemy for some reason, which I didn't know what to do about and didn't really have any experience with. So I just tried harder. I just worked harder to compensate. And eventually I did manage to sort of have a low-key confrontation with her, but it didn't make any difference. She was scornful of me and felt like I was not a worthy person to be teaching in the school and would never make it. But the harder it got, the harder I worked. I would get up very early in the morning, sit a little bit of zazen, which would mostly just make me feel crazier because I would see how wound up the mind was, ride my bike, you know, dawn or before dawn across this beautiful island to work in the school hours before most of the other teachers, preparing, you know, great lessons and all this stuff. I had great support at home. My wife, Janet, was doing everything she could to keep me afloat. But my biggest enemy was probably myself, because I was not content to just go with the textbooks and do a pretty good job. I had to create everything from scratch because it wasn't good enough. I was fresh and excited, but really suffering. It just seems like the way you were supposed to do it and the thing you were supposed to do. And teaching the way it's done, you know, you're really your own agent. It's very autonomous, which is a way is great and a way is terrible, because there's nobody looking over your shoulder telling you, you know, you could lighten up a little bit. You don't have to work that hard, you know. Kids will be fine, you know. So I figured I had a really big and important job to do, and I had to do it really well. These kids were counting on me. So I survived a year somehow. I don't know how, really. And I was willing to take another run at it, you know, maybe thinking it would be kind of like student teaching. If I tried it again for a second year, it would be all better. I would do it in a less stressful way. But through a combination of factors, I got laid off. And out on an island like that, if you get laid off, it pretty much means you're kicked off the island. It does, you know, because you can't afford to live there because there's no jobs. And we came back to Bellingham. And then the gates of school teaching just never really opened up for me again. I substitute taught. I tried really hard. I worked hard at it in the way that I seemed to do. or tried really hard to get another job. I did all the stuff you're supposed to do. I prepared like crazy. I got lots of interviews. I had a really great resume, an incredible file. You know, I had this thing called a placement file. I remember I had like an amazing placement file. You know, the letters I have in there are unbelievable, you know. This guy is the best person you'll ever met, you know, they all would say, you know. If you don't hire him, you're making a deal. And so I had many interviews, I think about 20 teaching job interviews over a couple of years. 2 years, I think, I kept at this, trying to get a job. I was so, you know, I'm a teacher, I have to get a job, you know. And I had maybe 20 interviews, and every time I came in second or maybe third, every time. I was so qualified that they had to talk to me, they had to interview me, you know, they wanted to interview me. But somehow they never wanted to hire me. And you never really know why you don't get hired for a job, you know, it's such a difficult thing, getting a job. But I did get pretty good after a while at prying bits of information out of that like 2 minute rejection call that you get from the principal. And eventually, one of the principals confided to me, "Well, Tim, you seem like such a smart guy. I think we could really use you in the middle school." I was applying for first grade, you know. "We could really use you in the middle school." I was really upset. Like, what is that, you know? They don't want smart people in the first grade? And I remember in that particular interview, it was probably the dumbest thing I could have said. They asked me, what do you particularly bring to first grade? You know, and they probably wanted to hear, you know, I'm a very warm person or something like that. And I said, "I have a fantastic science curriculum." Which is really relevant and true, actually, you know. And in fact, Walker's kindergarten teacher did quite good science with him, and so maybe they're coming around, you know, but I think they were kind of like, maybe the middle school. Mrs. Jones is really nice, you know. Anyway. So maybe if I had relaxed and been a little more mellow, shown my nice, sweet side, you know, been a little more cuddly, I'd be teaching first grade now. And probably wouldn't really have had time to come to the Zendo all these times, and never would have ordained, and I don't know, maybe we wouldn't be sitting here, I don't know. Maybe one of you guys would be giving the talk, probably be better. But, circling back to the point, there's a point to why I'm telling you my resume. At that point, I put all my teaching stuff away. I had boxes and boxes of files and materials and books and stuff I'd bought. One of the nutty things about the schools is the teachers spend their own money for a lot of the materials. So if you have a teacher friend, you know, take them shopping or something. So I have enormous amounts of stuff, you know, science stuff, math manipulatives, microscopes, everything. I took all this stuff and I put it in boxes. I built a great big shelf in our garage and put it there. And there it has sat for the last 8 years until last weekend. So what am I telling you about my career? Well, the first thing is that I've learned from Norman that actually the first job in a Dharma talk is to provide a little entertainment. So I was hoping it would be entertaining and interesting. But there is a point, because over this last long weekend, I finally went through my boxes and started preparing to give it all away, that it finally was time to let go of being a school teacher. Like, yeah, mostly when people ask me what I do, I said, well, I used to be a teacher, but now I need to not say that anymore. That my paid work in the end is right back to where I started when I was 16 years old, programming computers. And I have to admit that that's the way the economy and the universe sent me. And even though it's maybe not my first choice, maybe my second choice of a money career is just fine. And it really is just fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Lately, I'm a little bored sometimes doing this work. But as I study all this, I see how there's a real arrogance and pride to that thought of being bored at work. It has an element of not attending to what you're really doing. And it has a sort of arrogance to it. You know, I mean, especially in my case, you know, here I have a well-paid, flexible, reasonably low-stress job. I work from home. That enables me to support my family and leaves quite a bit time free, it appears, for Zen practice. So where do I get off indulging in the thought that I deserve something different? Work is work. And maturity, a part of maturity, and maybe in a way my avoidance of thinking I have a career is sort of an avoidance of maturity. That part of maturity is being willing to do what you need to do without complaint. So in computer programming, there's a new concept in computer programming called technical debt. That's really helpful. The idea of technical debt is that there's often a quick and dirty way to write a program which will get the job done for the moment, but it might not really be the best thing to do in the long run. The quick and dirty way might have a bug in there somewhere. It might be harder to read or harder to revise, but it is quick. It can get the job done. So you can do it the quick and dirty way, or you can do it the more labor-intensive, elegant way, which often involves rewriting a lot of the surrounding computer code so that the new bit will work well with the old bit and the whole thing will sort of be rethought in the context of this change. And the good way is easier to maintain, better in the long run, and less buggy, but takes longer. And so the idea of technical debt is recognizing that there are times when we do the quick and dirty way. It makes sense. The deadline or the situation calls for doing it that way, but that there's a consequence. That when we do things the quick and dirty way, we are incurring a kind of debt. And that's technical debt in computer programming. The whole project now has a load of debt that you're going to have to pay back later, sometime later, next month or next year. Somebody goes in to work on something and they see this big mess in there and they're going to have to spend time cleaning that up. So I was thinking about this when I was looking at my boxes in the dusty shop, that likewise we often incur a psychological debt or a spiritual debt when we shelve our problems, when we decide to avoid what's difficult. But that might be appropriate, that there are times when we can't or we won't or we shouldn't deal with real problems. There are times when we really should stick our unfinished projects, our aborted careers, and our difficult relationships into a box in the dusty garage and leave them there. try to forget about them. But the point of this idea of technical debt is that you can't forget about them. They're there. When we stick stuff in the corner, figuratively or physically, when we leave important things undone, we're holding a debt. And those debts weigh us down. They really weigh us down. And they're important. So that was my initial sense as I started to go through my teacher boxes. Here was a big debt. The debt of a career not fulfilled, of an identity changed, of something happening to me that didn't seem fair, of things not going the way I wanted, even though I worked as hard as I possibly could, of my usual strategy, like not working. And when I started to go through my teacher boxes, I thought, well, maybe now I can clear this debt. But as I worked through this process of going through my boxes, I found that there was more going on than just clearing this debt. Or maybe that clearing this debt had a more transformational effect than just like a mechanical sort of process of taking a load off my shoulders. Somehow, I found I was learning something new and important about renunciation and ambition and emptiness and the great emptiness teachings of Buddhism from my dusty teacher boxes and also from my wife. And it hasn't been easy. I really have been meaning to go through those boxes for years. I mean, I've known for some years that they're not likely ever to be used, but I haven't been able to face them. So over the long weekend, and I was actually driven by the power of a project, which is a great motivator in my life. And so sometimes you can use your compulsions to good, you know, which is skillful means, right? So the project is that we want to make a little playhouse for my son in the same building, in this shop building. And so all these boxes and all the other junk in there is in the way. And so it really seemed embarrassing. I mean, I could sort of deal with the embarrassment of having these 10, 20-year-old teacher boxes in there. That's not too bad, but to deprive Walker of this playhouse because I couldn't go through my junk, you know, that was more than I could do. So that project got me started. And now I've gone through all the boxes. I have a large pile of stuff for the goodwill, for recycling, to give away to teachers who are practicing. And looking through all this stuff has been really eye-opening because enough time has gone by that I can actually see, mostly, that the person who did all that was not me. The person who did all those things and had all those adventures and all that stress and accomplished all that stuff was not me. Well, he was me, but he also wasn't me. I experienced the way time going by helps us sometimes to release from how caught we are in our story. But they always say that time heals, and maybe that's how time heals. Though we have a moment-by-moment sense of continuity and personhood that has a real strong hold over us in the short term. And it's one of the things that we study in meditation practice. Wait, now what is that? Is that real? But what I was discovering, noticing, is that if you put a few years in there, it all seems a lot less solid, a bit less believable. Was the me of yesterday the same me as the me of today? Sure, yeah, that was me. But what about the me of 10 years ago? Or 20 years ago? Or 30 or 40? Was that the same me? Me as a young child? Was that the same person? So maybe time actually heals us by eroding our confidence in a myth, the myth of the self, so that we can be more flexible and more responsive to the current reality, able to let go. So at the time when I was teaching and creating the things that fill these boxes, I was just doing my thing. The 8-10 year ago me was doing his thing, doing his best. And at the time I didn't think too much about the approach, I just went for it. That's what you're supposed to do. But looking at this stuff 8 years later, in the situation of my present life, I'm really astounded, actually. I was really amazed by what I saw. Mostly that this collection of materials, the amount of stuff I was looking at, it's like the amount of stuff that would have been amassed over the course of like a 10-year teaching career by a normal person. It was unbelievable how much stuff there was, you know. Like, I really couldn't believe it. I was, like, astounded. You know, yeah, I could talk for hours about all this stuff. It was amazing, you know. I got some really smart, well-designed stuff too. I was like, wow, look at that, you know. This is, you know, the collection of a maniacal worker, you know. I was really amazed. Like, who could have done that, you know? And so I think that helps us to learn about the self and our tendencies when we can see ourself as not ourself, you know, a little more objectively. So it's a wonder I survived those years of teaching. But once in a while, I'd hit something that would really grab my gut. That letter that I wrote over spring break to my teaching partner, asking her why she was treating me that way, what was going on, the student teaching evaluations, thank you and goodbye letters from the students, these beautiful children, suffering in their own ways, but so beautiful. Sometimes I was barely able to keep going through these boxes. I'd hit an object that was so intense to experience. At the same time that I was going through all this stuff, working my way through my teacher box's history, I also had been trying to sit down with my wife, you know, because we were both home for the long weekend. I keep trying to meet with her to talk about my future. And I was thinking of this in a very separate category in my brain. You know, my future as a priest and working with the community and all the other things I might do. Because I've been dimly aware lately that I need to do much better, and including my wife, like in the big picture planning, you know. It's no good for her if I just kind of come up, you know, the week before an event and say, gee, is it all right if I'm gone on Saturday? Yeah, it's really an important retreat, and the people are really counting on me, and yeah, you know. Because she feels really sort of, you know, like there's nothing dependable there, you know, like I'm going to be gone any second, you know. Makes her feel sort of picked apart. So I'm like, aha, I need to make a big plan, and this is very rational, you know, and I'll include my wife in the big plan, and then we'll be in this together, and then it'll feel good, and I can do everything I want, right? Seems to be what I was thinking, you know. So immediately after our sesshin, we had recently a long retreat, and, you know, I always am advising people during the retreat, don't make any plans, you know, it's a powerful transformational event. You know, settle down, and then you can make new plans later if you think that there's a big change in your life. And so what do I do? Immediately after the retreat, like the next morning, I write an enormous plan, you know. My next 10, 5 or 10 or 20 years of Dharma practice. You know, it's a brainstorm. It's good to write these things down, right? It's a brainstorm, you know. Kind of gets it out of my head. It's a good thing to do. And so over this long weekend, I was going through my teacher boxes, being astounded by all that. I was trying to sit down with my wife, which I finally did. And so here's the plan. It's an outline. How to increase priest and related work and drop programming for corporations. That's my goal, right? Section 1, more Zen programs. Point A, Saturday morning sits. Low impact on family. Leads to other Saturday activities easily. Point B, one day or half day sesshin. Gives people a chance to do deep zazen, maybe do oryoki. Point C, lead weekend retreats with Kate and Michael. Point D, teach classes Monday evenings and Friday afternoons. Section 2, community-oriented programs. Point A, Zen community workshops at Woodstock Farm. Proven and easy to do. Those are really fun, too. Point B, teach meditation in other places. Co-op connection, hospital programs. Point C, workshops on healing and relationship with the body. Section 3, other sitting groups. Point A, visit White Rock sitting group regularly. Monthly? Monday nights? Point B, start a new sitting group in Mount Vernon. There's no sitting group there. Does it have to be weekly? Or is twice a month workable? Point C. Seattle Soto Zen, visit on Sundays. But only once every other month. I had some restraint. Give me credit here. A little bit. Section 4. Family programs at the Dharma Hall. Point A, Friday noon parent meditation. Get on the publicity now. Point B, first and third Saturday Buddhist Youth Service Corps. Compassion group. Target 10 to 16-year-olds and their parents. Important offering. Section 5. I better skip the rest of it. There's 11 points. So my wife very patiently read all this. Yeah. And I explained that I didn't want to do all this right away. I understood that, you know. I don't know what, you know, it must have been so overwhelming. I can't imagine. But I was, you know, it made sense to me. But then she told me something that is important. And she's told me before, and maybe I'll get this through my thick skin, that sometimes she feels like she's the last thing that I'm thinking about. And, you know, I love my wife, and I would never want her to feel that way. So I was shocked anew. Even though she's told me that before, which is embarrassing, but true. And I always mean to do better at expressing my love for her and holding that relationship as the primary expression of my living, to be more fulsome in practicing through my family first. But that's always where I start. And so she'll tell me these things, and I'll be upset with myself, and embarrassed, and apologize, and do my best, and remember what a completely wonderful woman I am married to, vow to do better. But before long, I get busy. I get to work. I get in harness. So we had a new, and maybe I hope a deeper round of that kind of discussion before she even wanted to talk about my 11 points. But then she was willing to talk about my 11 points. And then she said something casually and matter-of-factly that for some reason was a real turning for me. She said, "Wow, you're very ambitious about this priest stuff." And something about, she says something about when the, you know, and the usual thing, that of course when the time is right, she has confidence in me, and little by little, but maybe not right now, and all these very reasonable, helpful things. But the first thing she said was, "Wow, that's really ambitious." And I was really surprised by that. Me, ambitious? I have to admit, she's right. I mean, the evidence is pretty clear between my boxes and my 11-point plan. But I don't think that I'm ambitious. That's not part of my story of who I am. I'm not an ambitious person. I'm not a career person. I'm flexible. I'm adaptable. I'm committed. I can work hard. But I respond. I'm not ambitious. And you definitely have a right to laugh at all this. And I've, over the last few years, I think, owned up more fully to myself my addiction to productivity and getting stuff done, for not being very good sometimes at relaxing and just appreciating things as they are. But ambition? That feels like a much bigger concept. That's the kind of thing that drives people and holds them. Is ambition driving me? Somehow that put my whole life in a new light, and I really felt a shift. It's hard to describe. But something in the process of facing my work life past and going through my boxes has been, and facing this idea of ambition, has been hugely emotionally and transformational. And if all this Buddhist teaching and meditation doesn't teach us that we're not just this little person inside this skin, if we're not convinced by that, another thing that really helps to convince us of the limits of that sort of narrow view of who we are is the power of these deep emotional stories of the objects in our lives. We really are these things. These are not external things that are separate from me over here. We are these things that we invest energy and emotion and meaning in. Handling these things that I'd used and put so much energy into, the stuff that reminded me of intense successes and incredible failure, it was really like holding my own body. It was really feeling wounds in the body and feeling strength and energy in the body. We are all of these things that we touch and hold. We are them and they are us. We are everything. But we're not really anything solid either. So it was a strange experience standing there in the middle of our shop, feeling the power of these objects, and then turn around and put them away in a box and let them go. Something was shifting. And I was really thinking then about renunciation. That renunciation for me is having a new meaning through this. And Norman and other teachers, you know, the Buddha are always talking about renunciation, key part of the Buddhist path. But not putting the body and mind in a position, you know, to activate things that lead to suffering. And I've always heard that as letting go of sense pleasures, and I've never really had much resonance for me, renunciation. You know, like, renunciation, what's the big deal about renunciation? I mean, I definitely enjoy pleasures and chocolate and lattes and going to the movies. And, you know, I love our house and all this stuff, you know. But actually, I really think I'd be just as happy, really, living in a tent, you know, with a few battered Tom Robbins paperbacks eating stale crackers. I really don't think the stuff really makes that much of a difference to me. So renunciation never had much hold on my sort of practice life and imagination. But renunciation of ambition, now we're talking. What would that be? That's actually pretty scary. Being aware of this powerful form of desire that's underlain so much of what I've done, seeing that a little more clearly, being alert for when ambition arises, working with it more directly. Oh, there's ambition. Instead of getting excited and spitting out more five-year plans and working hard, nobody else has gotten around to fixing the front door trim. I think I'll do that tonight. And so on. I don't think this means that I need to not do anything anymore. There's probably no hope of that. I'm not worried about not doing stuff. But it brings a different light to planning and thinking about the future and how I act in this moment. I mean, sure, some of my plans are probably excellent, but what good is all that if I'm running around, caught on a string by ambition, leaning forward all the time, always looking to the next project, trying to think how to do things better, trying to think how to optimize and improve, and not really appreciating what is. If I'm sitting there during Zazen time thinking about improvement, what good is all of that? And what good is any of this if I let my home life be less than wonderful? If I sacrifice my wonderful family in even the smallest way on the altar of ambition. And so I need to learn how to do planning and decision making with the spirit of renunciation. Renouncing ambition, but still moving forward in life. Appreciating the deep perfection of what is as the central piece, not what's missing. So renunciation means to renounce something. The first meaning of renounce is to give something up, you know, not to choose something. And that's the obvious meaning. I could renounce coffee. You probably could too. That'll probably be a fine thing. But it's not really the important thing. The second definition of renounce is to stop following. To stop following something. To stop following someone or something. To stop following ambition. To stop following desire, or when trouble arises, not to follow aversion and turn away. So that seems to me the renunciation of the Buddha and his students over these years. Don't follow that. If something is arising that leads to suffering, just don't follow that. And we can study that in meditation very directly. Painful thoughts arise, they arise, but you don't need to follow them. It's possible. So I want to encourage all of us to think about this. What are the debts that you are carrying? What is driving you? And is it time? Are you ready to retire one or two of those debts? Is it time to face the dusty boxes of your life? And, it's time to stop. It's an ambitious talk. skip that bit. I had a like really cool few points about the paramitas, but who cares? Point of all this is there really is a lot of power and a lot of healing that really is available to us when we're ready, when we have enough support, and it seems like we really do need another perspective, or even to say these things out loud in front of people, so we can see much more clearly than we could ever see on our own. But there is a really a power and a real opening and a possibility for awakening in facing these dusty and scary corners of our lives. Not all at once, little by little, as we're strong enough, to start to retire these debts. And it makes perfect sense that we have debts. There's nothing wrong with that. We're not bad people. It's just what suffering beings would naturally do in this crazy world. You would take on debt. You would take on some psychological and spiritual debt to survive, to keep moving. That's natural. But to let those debts hold us down and keep us unnecessarily in suffering is what a shame. What a shame that would be. To prevent us from appreciating and really enjoying our life fully. And even worse, to prevent us from really feeling love and really being loved by those who love us. And so anyway, I thought tonight, with you all as witnesses, I hereby renounce ambition.
It's pretty ambitious.
I already blew it, huh? We'll see how I do. Little by little, you know. So, that's my little, my ambitious talk about my weekend. My long talk. My weekend. About ambition. So what is it, you know? What is that for you? And it really is possible. You know, we really can have faith that with support and practice, we can work with these things, you know, even the scariest things, little by little. They will open up. Thank you very much. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way, being